From the Hollywood Hills to Capitol Hill, it's fall 2008, and this is Intern Edition. Oysters usually come ready to eat, sitting chilled in their shells on a plate in a restaurant, or even stuffed in a jar. But a lot of work goes into getting to these little meaty morsels.
A lot of people from up here in the north, they actually shuck it from the lip of the oyster, but I do it from the butt end of it. It's hand shucking is what some of these guys have called it.
Marian Anderson's voice filled the National Mall in Washington during her historic 1939 concert. But the Lincoln Memorial wasn't the first choice for where she would sing. I'm Spencer Raymond. These stories and more coming up on Intern Edition. Soviet Safeway, Sandinista Safeway, Sexy Safeway. To someone not living here in Washington, these names mean nothing. But for those who do live in D.C., these names mean something. But what's in a name? Scott Pham has the story, aisle 9.
Anthony, you need the Office of Customer Assistance, please, Anthony?
In Washington, D.C., there's one supermarket chain that seems to have a little more character than the rest. Safeway. I talked to Craig Muckle, the public affairs manager for all the East Coast Safeway grocery stores, and he told me that in D.C., the Safeways, and only the Safeways, have nicknames.
We've heard anything from the Social Safeway to the Secret Safeway to, most recently with our City Vista store on 490 L Street Northwest, the Sexy Safeway.
And don't forget, Craig's least favorite nickname.
The Soviet Safeway.
All of these nicknames are based on the store's reputation. The Soviet Safeway is supposed to be brutal, with empty shelves and bread lines, reminiscent of long winters under Stalin. The Social Safeway is supposed to be like a constant singles night. And the Sexy Safeway, the newest of them all, has that ultra-modern, boutique look to it. The list goes on. It's good fun, but it all seems like way too much personality for a national chain store. I decided to investigate, starting with the Soviet Safeway. But as soon as I step in, I know I'm not in the USSR.
Lettuce, tomato, avocado, and aioli dressing, all served on our focaccia roll.
The store is small. A lot of the aisles are ridiculously narrow. And all the carts are half the size of a normal cart. But as I walk through the store, it's a struggle to find that Soviet poverty that I've heard so much about. Here I am now, in the rather well-stocked bread aisle.
Well, they're a little low on Hostess snack cakes. You can point that out. Yeah, to be honest, I'm a little disappointed. It's not exactly what I thought a grocery store in Soviet Russia might look like.
So, how to explain the nickname? A nearby shopper, David Warner, helped me understand.
It's improved a lot in the last couple of years. I don't think it really has much of a nickname anymore. I still hear it, but not as often as I used to. I've been in the neighborhood 25 years, and it was the only way people referred to the Safeway years ago, and now they just call it Safeway.
Some people still use these nicknames, but for the most part, David's right. It's gone out of style.
So you know about DC's habit of nicknaming their Safeways?
What?
No, not that I know of.
Excuse me?
Well, have you ever heard of somebody call this Safeway the Soviet Safeway?
No, I never heard.
No, I ain't never hear that.
No.
For me, this was really disappointing. I liked the idea of all these big supermarkets having their own identities and personalities. I'm already nostalgic for the days when every store had a nickname that everybody used. But shoppers like David don't miss those times at all.
It was a bad experience. It was the only store in the neighborhood that was accessible, there was no competition, so they pretty much got away with a lot of stuff that the store wasn't very wholesome. The floors were dirty.
It used to be that the local Safeway was the only option for a lot of neighborhoods. Now that people have more choices, Safeway has had to clean up their act. They offer more of a selection now, and they're redesigning their stores to make them look more upscale. More health food oriented and more friendly. David loves it.
They've improved a lot in the last few years. It's remarkable, in fact.
But at the same time, it's come at a cost. It's made them more similar. Just ask Harry Tosin, a shopper at the hard to find Secret Safeway.
Do you think all Safeways are the same, or is each one?
All of them are the same. All Safeways are good. I go to all Safeways, but I prefer this one. To me, out of fairness, it's more comfortable. It's a comfortable, safe way to come to where you don't have to be in a hurry.
I think Harry's right that there's comfort in this sameness. When you wander through a Safeway, you're in every Safeway. You know that the bread aisle is on one side of the store with the wine, and the produce is on the other side, near the condiment aisle. You've got the Safeway brand foods, the Safeway Muzak on the speakers, and that friendly red S everywhere you look. Even if you've never been there before, you're not lost. You know exactly where you are. I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, a guaranteed personality. For Intern Edition, I'm Scott Pham.
Downtown Los Angeles has one of the largest homeless populations in the western United States. The Los Angeles Homeless Services Coalition estimates 80,000 people sleep on the streets every night. There are nearly 4,000 homeless in the Skid Row area alone. There are a number of aid organizations that offer shelter and food, but some community members are taking their own initiative to make sure no one goes hungry. From NPR West, Michelle Lanz has more.
In a modest craftsman-style duplex just west of the downtown LA skyline, Todd and Adriana stir a giant stockpot full of beans and rice. The kitchen is sweltering as 10 to 15 people begin to crowd into the tiny room, forming an assembly line. Some scoop the bean and rice mixture onto large tortillas, some fold burritos, and others put on the final wrap of wax paper and tin foil.
So it's kind of a science. We like to consider ourselves like at a master's level, working on a PhD.
That's Adriana and Jesse, the resident tortilla toasters. Once a week, the house is transformed into the headquarters of the LA Burrito Project.
Salsa, who wants to open it?
It is a small collective of like-minded bike enthusiasts who pedal the downtown Skid Row to feed the dense homeless population. Some members prefer to only use their first names, and they insist that they aren't doing this for recognition. Since their inception in 2006, the group has only missed 1 week of deliveries. During the busy summer months when volunteer numbers swell, they feed up to 500 people in one trip. The group is also self-funded. Members donate what they can every week, and the rest is supplemented with occasional donations from local restaurants. Todd, the main organizer, explains that it's more than just money that keeps the Burrito Project afloat.
Everybody's pretty close here, so it's nice, you know? Yeah. There's not too many people that come through this door that I don't consider one of my best friends, you know? So it's nice.
The idea came about when Todd learned about a similar group in the Mission District of San Francisco. The idea has even spread to other cities in the U.S., and it has inspired a falafel project based in Syria. Tonight, artists, teachers, bike messengers, and students make up the eclectic bunch of do-gooders united for a simple cause, as Todd explains.
Like, we're not pushing any, like, political ideals here. We're not, like, there's no agenda.
Dan Zahn has participated in the Burrito Project for about a year and says friendly human contact can be just as nourishing as a hot meal.
And I think the reason I come back and do this again and again is there's really that connection, and you can really feel it here more than any other place, and I think that's way more important than giving out a burrito.
We set off into the night, and after an easy 10-minute ride, we're in the center of Skid Row. We find a group of men sleeping on cardboard boxes under the awning of a retail store.
Hi, boy. Hey, how are you? Good, how are you doing?
Okay. The exchange happens quickly, and in just minutes, we're back on our bikes to the next group. The homeless population used to be more concentrated in the area, but the city has been actively trying to stem the issue for years. Todd says he has noticed a definite change in the transient population in downtown L.A. since beginning the project.
Yeah, it's like next 3 blocks that were going on for a while were like really, really populated. Now there's nobody on them.
We round a corner and find a block spotted with tents and more makeshift cardboard shelters. The silence is broken only by the voices of the Burrito Project members. There's an uneasy, sour smell in the air, a mixture of garbage, standing water, and body odor. Todd says his perception of the homeless has changed, and he now realizes that Skid Row isn't just inhabited by prostitutes and drug addicts.
It's not like there's some like cookie-cutter image of like what a homeless person is. It's like there's so many families out there.
It takes about an hour to hand out all the burritos and waters.
I have waters.
And then comes the difficult task of telling those still waiting that there's nothing left.
I don't think that this is at all like any kind of like solution to a homeless problem in downtown Los Angeles. This is like a chance to get a bunch of people and to see that there's another side of it.
Whether or not the Burrito Project makes a major impact on the homeless population as a whole, It is clear that their unwavering efforts can at least offer the less fortunate in their community a warm meal and a friendly face. For Intern Edition, I'm Michelle Lance.
It's Intern Edition. I'm Spencer Raymond. Most people have taken a cab before, but what about a pedicab?
You guys need a ride?
Human-powered rickshaws first appeared in Japan around 1868 during the Meiji Restoration. Today, the concept remains essentially the same, a bike attached to a carriage and some lucky soul to pedal it. So what's it like in Washington, D.C.?
I'll swing you guys around.
Oh, Lord!
Intern Edition Spencer Thanhouser takes us for a spin.
Well, there you go.
Just substitute for pedicab.
Woo-hoo!
We'll get you where you need to go.
All right.
Listen to A Virtuous Cycle, Confessions from a DC Pedicab, only on npr.org/internedition. English satirist Jonathan Swift once wrote, "He was a bold man that first eat an oyster, and boy was he right. But half the battle is getting those darn things open." Ben Platt visited the National Oyster Shucking Competition in Leonardtown, Maryland this fall to learn about the time-honored practice of opening oysters.
You're not the only oyster in the stew.
Brad Carroll is practicing his shucking skills with other contestants 2 hours before the final shuck-off. He's cracking open hundreds of oysters to feed the thousands of hungry people crowding into this Southern Maryland festival.
Of course, some of them are a little bit harder than the others, that's for sure.
It's not easy work, but Brad and his fellow shuckers can crack open most oysters with speed and a certain grace. It's amazing how many different ways there are to open up these tough-shelled creatures.
A lot of people from up here in the north, they actually shuck it from the lip of the oyster, but I do it from the butt end of it. It's hand shucking is what some of these guys have called it. And then a lot of times you might hear me doing that right there, that's me banging my knife. What that does is that cleans all the debris off my oyster knife.
Keeping his knife clean might be the thing that wins Brad this competition. To win, you don't just have to be the first to shuck all your oysters. You have to be the fastest shucker of quality oysters. Shuckers need to watch out for dirt, pieces of shell, sliced oyster flesh, or anything that might make someone balk at paying God knows what price in a fancy restaurant to eat them. Flaws mean penalty points.
No mud, no blood, and that being your own blood, yeah. Because I have seen that before, too.
That's Robert Daffin, a competitor from Florida. He's one of the old hands who encouraged Brad to compete here today.
It's the first time Brad, like I said, has been up here, and he's placed in the top six. He's beaten me, and I've been doing it for 30 years. So. And then we're just rooting for him to take in the top three this time.
Making it this far is an achievement in itself. The stakes are high. Whoever wins here today goes on to compete in the International Oyster Festival in Galway, Ireland, for the world title. William Robert Young Jr., known as Chopper, is the current title holder. While the other contestants are busy practicing, Chopper is enjoying a quiet moment out by the amateur shucking stage. He's feeling pretty confident being back on his home turf.
Very relaxed. It's great. Usually there's a lot of stress, you know, and get all uptight and worry about, you know, winning. But today, I'm already at the top, so what I do today is just another good day.
Chopper is right to feel confident. He won this competition last year. The crowd is also excited that Chopper's back, and they're eager for him to get on stage. The men dive in and begin shucking their hearts out. They're methodical, determined, hands twisting, knives glittering, sweat pouring from their faces. They're shucking faster than I could ever hope to without slicing my hand open, slamming the empty shells on the ground with one hand while the other is already reaching for the next oyster. Brad is going strong just to the left of Chopper, who, unlike the other contestants, is dancing and laughing with the music, tossing empty shells out to the audience. The crowd goes wild as Chopper wins the second year in a row with a whopping 1 minute 42 seconds and no penalties. Obviously, Brad wished he'd done better. He blames his defeat, in part, on intimidation, with the world champion shucking and singing beside him.
Well, he's right next to me, so I can see him out of the corner of my eye. He finished at least 10 or 15 seconds, probably faster than me. And I'm not going to lie, whenever when he finished up, I got a little shaky, and then I was like, that son of a gun.
But it's all in good fun. By the end of the day, all the contestants were smiling and slapping each other on the back, taking photos together, laughing over their scores. Despite the fierce competition, what really unites these people from across the country is their love of the craft and of each other. Though defeated yesterday, Robert is happy to be here with his fellow shuckers.
It's really just like a big family reunion for all of us because we all know each other from other competitions. And we get together, have a good time, and share a few jokes and make fun of each other. So.
For NPR's Intern Edition, I'm Ben Platt.
Calling an 800 number and getting an automated voice can be frustrating.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
But more and more, these machines are sounding like real people.
Sure, I can help you order some fresh hot pizza.
Now, many companies are trying to make new automated voice systems more palatable. Catherine Wells has the story.
Automated voice systems use futuristic speech recognition technology and pleasant personas to soothe frustrated callers. Voices like this one from Assurant Health are designed to think and react like real people. For example,
you can explain what you want just as though you were talking to a real person.
Older systems frustrated consumers by asking them to repeat information constantly. But new systems understand a wider range of responses. Here's the old system.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Compared to the new one.
There you are, I gotcha.
And the new systems are friendlier, too. Interactions Technology is a leading designer of this kind of technology. This is what you might hear if you called a pizza place using one of their automated systems.
Sure, I can help you order some fresh hot pizza.
According to Interactions, this kind of enthusiasm and informality, fake typing sounds included, is getting an overwhelming response from consumers. Many even thank the automated voice for his courteous service.
You're the best automated guy ever.
Hey man, you've been all right, dog. Thanks.
You're amazing.
But some consumers find the ever-increasing informality of computer voice systems to be, well, weird.
And I'm sitting here laughing at myself the whole time. I'm going, this is stupid.
That's Ben Fry. He's a former customer service representative and a blogger who's written about his disconcerting experiences with automated systems. He says he feels stupid because he's friendly to the voice on the other end of the line, even though he knows it's a recording.
I felt like an idiot because he's not a real person, and I'm telling him to have a nice day. You know, I could have told him to jump off a building, and it wouldn't hurt his feelings whatsoever, but for some reason I still told this computer to have a nice day.
Some industry analysts call this reaction the creepiness factor. Walt Tetchner is a consumer advocate on GetHuman2.com. He says it's patronizing for companies to assume callers will forget they're talking to a machine and that savvy consumers don't like being talked down to.
You're really trying to fool me, and I'm not that stupid. You know, that's basic human nature. Even though they don't say that, no one likes to think that they're being fooled.
This consumer backlash has caused some companies to change their systems back to a machine-like voice. Bruce Ballantyne is a researcher and principal for the Enterprise Integration Group. He says these overly friendly voices are a part of what he calls Jetsonian thinking. Remember the old Jetsons cartoon? Where all they had to do was push a button and a hot meal or space car or robot maid would appear? Ballantyne says automated systems designers think that consumers want this Jetsonian life, that they want everything done for them.
It was a wonderful futuristic vision of a model of American consumerism that's based on the assumption that consumers are stupid and lazy.
But consumers aren't lazy, Ballantyne says. In fact, they don't even mind talking to a machine that sounds like a machine. All they really want is a quick, efficient interaction.
The goal is to make the user experience more appealing so that the machine will be more conversational. It turns out that end users don't care for that, and that what end users prefer is a machine that's easy to operate.
So Ballantyne urges system designers to steer far away from the casual tones and friendly musings of automated personas. With the economic crisis forcing more people to do more for themselves, the development of new technologies like automated language systems may slow down anyway. Ballantyne says the Jetsonian philosophy is on its way out. He adds that as consumer complaints rise, we'll see less bad imitations of humans and more good machines. So you'll be able to save the enthusiastic compliments for a real, live person. For Intern Edition, I'm Catherine Wells.
You are listening to Intern Edition. You can find more Intern Edition stories on the Intern Edition website. Intern profiles and web exclusives are available online at npr.org/internedition. With the economy tanking, one industry remains strong: video games. A new consumer study estimates this year 22% of holiday shoppers will buy games as gifts. This entertainment isn't a complete escape from economic reality, though. Many games have their own virtual economies, and increasingly, they resemble the real world. Rebecca Pulsifer went to a gaming convention in Southern California to learn more.
BlizzCon, one of the largest conventions for online gamers, takes place each year in Anaheim, right around the corner from Disneyland. Mickey Mouse ears are expected in this city, but costumes like Philip Jenke's still stand out.
It's basically a large cow on two legs, to put it simply. I'm actually walking in hooves. They're about 9-inch heels.
Jenke, a computer tech from Ohio, drove across the country to compete in the BlizzCon costume contest. He modeled his outfit after his avatar in the online game World of Warcraft. He's one of over 10 million players worldwide who spend an average of 17 hours a week battling monsters in Azeroth, a fantasy-themed world. Doing battle doesn't come cheap. Matt Mowdy, another World of Warcraft player, said lately he's paying more for virtual items his avatar needs. Mowdy's avatar is a healer. The medicine he uses in his virtual profession is more expensive than it's been in the past.
The prices are getting out of reach of your average player. I couldn't afford to do some of the stuff I wanted to do unless I went out and do really boring stuff for a few hours to actually go and do an hour or two of fun gameplay.
Boring stuff, like repetitive missions called daily quests. In the game, Mowdy's avatar spends hours finding hidden items and selling them for gold. Once he has enough, Mowdy can go back to doing something fun in the game. Other players want to avoid that drudgery and save time. They buy virtual gold with real dollars. It's known as real money trading, not unlike, say, buying euros for dollars. Julian Dibble knows this system well. His book, Play Money, describes his experiment making a living selling gold for real money to players hungry to get ahead.
They acquire over time a fortune. Imaginary in some ways, but in other ways very real. But because these things are so hard to get a hold of in the game, people will look for other players who are willing to sell their treasures for real money, and thus they can skip the hard work.
There's so much demand that entire corporations specializing in this practice have cropped up online. Julian Dibble estimates these middleman operations make hundreds of millions of dollars each year. Despite its popularity, real money trading was still a taboo subject at BlizzCon. One World of Warcraft player, Fred, wouldn't even share his last name when asked.
Where do you sell your gold?
I don't sell my gold. That's against the terms of service.
What happens in the game if they find out people are selling gold?
If they have conclusive proof that you've bought or sold gold, they just go ahead and close your account permanently.
The makers of World of Warcraft have done their best to ban the real money trade because it puts new players at a disadvantage. Virtual cash floods the economy, inflating prices for players who prefer not to spend real dollars on their avatar. For players like Matt Mowdy, that investment sounds more like the real world than a game.
I don't know why anybody would actually spend money on a virtual item, because, I mean, the whole point of playing the game is to have fun, but I guess some people, they're willing to spend cash. And so the prices on pretty much everything are just going up and up and up and up.
The richest players can afford the latest virtual items, a fancy polar bear riding mount, the latest in sword technology, while poor players struggle to keep up. This leaves Julian Dibble wondering if games are the diversions they once were.
It's really hard to tell the difference and really hard to know when you've crossed the line from doing something fun and into doing work.
The game's makers think World of Warcraft will stay popular, but players like Matt Mowdy are frustrated as Azeroth seems increasingly like the real world. Except for one thing. You can always turn a game off. For Intern Edition from NPR West, I'm Rebecca Pulsifer.
I'm Spencer Raymond, and you're listening to Intern Edition. Barack Obama will be sworn in as America's first African-American president next year. But 2009 also marks the 70th anniversary of another event, when race, politics, and music collided. The 1939 Lincoln Memorial Concert, featuring African-American singer Marian Anderson. A mural in the Department of the Interior in Washington commemorates the event. Kyle Gassett visited the mural and has this look at Anderson's legacy.
There are two versions of the mural in the Department of the Interior. The original, at a large reproduction in the office of Melba Vaughn, the department's complaint manager for civil rights. 3 months ago, when Vaughn was looking for a piece of art from the department's collection to hang on her wall, she saw the mural, heard the story behind it, and she knew this was the one.
Well, I'm sure that anyone who looks at this will be amazed. I mean, it's really an excellent piece of work. And I'm so glad and honored to have it sitting in this office until I leave.
In the foreground of the mural, men, women, and children, both black and white, gather to listen to singer Marian Anderson, who is painted as a tiny figure on the steps of the memorial. According to the department's curator, David McKinney, the mural's artist, Mitchell Jameson, left an opening in the crowd, almost inviting the viewer to step in and listen.
Well, I think he wanted you to be part of the audience, and I think he wanted you to feel what the people in the audience were feeling. Again, that great deal of pride that here was an African-American woman, someone that shared the same struggle as most of the people right in the foreground of this mural did.
In 1939, Marian Anderson was already a star on the concert stage, with a voice that renowned conductor Arturo Toscanini said comes once in 100 years. But even she was not immune to racism. That year, after being invited to sing in Constitution Hall in Washington, she was told the audience would not be integrated. Anderson refused to perform, and in response, Walter White, president of the NAACP, arranged to have her sing Easter Morning on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The crowd that gathered that day numbered 75,000. Musicologist Alan Kyler has written an account of Marian Anderson's life. According to him, the concert and the attention it received was at times overwhelming for the singer. She wasn't always comfortable being a civil rights activist, and she wished to leave the entire account of the concert out of her autobiography.
It was sort of thrust upon her, and she took on that challenge with great dignity and courage, but she worked her entire life to sing well, and she was afraid that eventually people would only know the Lincoln Memorial Concert and not everything else about her as an artist.
But even though Anderson avoided what she termed hand-to-hand combat in the battle against racism, she acknowledged the power of her own voice in a 1979 interview with NPR.
To have things about you and the things that you're interested available to touch the lives of other people, to know that you have this instrument over which your voice can go, and know that there's something being said from which, if only a dozen people grasp your meaning, you have done a very great service.
Later in her career, Marian Anderson surpassed another racial barrier. In 1955, the Metropolitan Opera of New York asked her to sing in their upcoming performance of Verdi's Un ballo in maschera. After some initial hesitation, at the time she was 60 years old and had never performed in an opera, Anderson agreed to be the first black singer ever to perform at the Met. That January, the curtain rose on Anderson as the sorceress Ulrika in her only operatic role. According to Alan Kyler, at the sight of Anderson on stage, the audience stood and applauded before she even sang a note.
I mean, can you imagine? A black singer singing a major role at the Metropolitan Opera, not just any black singer. It's Marian Anderson, which meant it meant not only her voice and her artistry, but 20 or 30 years of history. Was sitting on that stage.
Since that January, many African-American singers have performed at the Met, including Leontine Price, Simon Estes, and soprano Denise Graves, who met Marian Anderson in 1992. Graves says Anderson communicated not only through her voice, but her spirit as well, and her career quietly and firmly paved the way for others.
We are standing on her shoulders. We owe her a great debt for what she paid. So I'm extremely honored and pay homage to this tremendous being and for what she did and what she opened.
America, as well as the other songs Marian Anderson sang in 1939, will be heard once again when Denise Graves performs a 70th anniversary reenactment concert this spring on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. For Intern Edition, I'm Kyle Gassett.
You've been listening to Intern Edition, a production of NPR's Next Generation Radio. Don't forget to visit us on the web at npr.org/internedition. You can hear more stories from the interns, get to know our faces, and check out original multimedia projects. It's all online at npr.org/internedition. A special thank you goes out to everyone who contributed to Intern Edition, including Michael Cullen. Our editor is Amy Blasick with assistance from Jacob Conrad. Our executive producer is Lacey Tatro. The Next Generation Radio Project Manager is Doug Mitchell. I'm Spencer Raymond, and thanks for listening.